Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, MMA, Spotify and the BPI. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
And the big question that literally zero people have asked me, which is slightly disappointing, is where the hell has the podcast been?
Where the hell has the podcast been?
I don't know.
I think it fell down the back of a shelf, and it was only when the cleaners were in and they moved the shelf away to dust behind that the podcast popped out, and here we are. I've been very busy.
You look at me like that's a valid excuse.
The Great Escape is looming. We are very close to May now because it's now April. Did you know it was April?
That is how the calendar works, yes.
After April comes May, and mm-hmm. in May is The Great Escape. We are presenting 3 CMU Insights conferences this year. As we speak, I am so close to having it fully booked. So close to having all the speakers booked. It's unbelievable that I'm here. I should be out there booking those final few speakers.
And you think that justifies 2 weeks of impromptu podcast hiatus?
Well, it's an excuse. I mean, it's not a good excuse, and it's not the actual excuse, but it is an excuse.
Yeah.
So our conference is looking really good. Keep an eye on the website. Education conference on 16th of May, AI conference on the 17th of May, and our China conference on the 18th of May, all taking place at The Great Escape. Come along.
Despite how this now looks, I did not start this conversation as a means for you to plug The Great Escape.
I've spent the last 2 days not finishing the booking of The Great Escape, although I should have been. I spent them at BIM in London, the music college, and all the music business students, final year, I think, were pitching business project in their final year. So some of that, it's releasing an EP of an artist they're working with, or putting on a tour or a night, or some of them come with really amazing sort of business ideas that they then try and pursue. There were 2 podcasts being pitched. One was very much focused on the conversation around music and mental health that we've talked about here and at The Great Escape. And then another one was basically a competitor to us, a weekly podcast looking at music business developments. So we better get our asses into gear and get this podcast out every week moving forward. Otherwise, there are other media waiting to fill that gap.
Yes. All right then. Well, let's apologise for the fact that the podcast disappeared for 2 weeks.
Except, as you said, nobody noticed. So
nobody did notice.
If you'd not brought it up, people would just be like, oh, there's another edition of Setlist.
People might have noticed that the last one that did go out, the sound quality was not very good.
The sound quality was particularly bad.
They didn't hear the one we recorded and then didn't even put out because it was so bad.
We had a number of technical problems. You know how at the start of last week's podcast, whenever that last one came out back in the early 70s, we talked at length at the start about how we were both recording from home and that was new and we didn't know what that was going to do to the audio. Well, take it from me, as the person who edited that edition, if you think it sounded bad when you got it in your podcast feed, you should have heard the edition that popped out of our collective recorders, which I then had to edit. That took about a month just to edit that one edition of the podcast.
Yes.
We're not here to talk about technical problems. We're in the studio.
We're back in the studio.
We are both in the studio.
Our esteemed producer, Matthew, here. So it's all back on track now.
Providing Matt has pressed play. No, record. Not play. Hopefully he hasn't pressed play.
This is why he's a professional.
Providing Matt has pressed record, then everything will be super and fine and this will be back to normal service. And you never know, we might now come out every single week forever. Probably not the week of The Great Escape. But we got a plan for that, which I'm not going to tell you about now in case it doesn't come off.
Good, because I also don't know what it is.
But we have a plan. It's a very exciting plan. But let's not talk about that. Let's talk about what we're talking about this week on the podcast.
This week on the podcast, we're going to talk about more growth for the UK record industry and what it's like being a shareholder in Spotify. But first, the Music Modernisation Act is back and it's bigger than ever before. This is the proposed US legislation to fix the way streaming services license song rights, which has now been rewritten to include most, though not all, of all the other music-related proposals that have been circulating around Washington of late.
Yes, so this all-new Music Modernisation Act I find it really hard not to write the Music Monetization Act. Does that ever actually get through to you when you're subbing and proofing my work?
I don't think I've corrected that, but that might not be a good thing.
That probably means on the website we frequently refer to it as the Music Monetization Act. It's the Music Modernization Act. We've talked about this before. It may sound familiar because the Music Modernization Act was put forward in Washington to Congress late last year. It went to the House of Representatives. It went to the Senate. Everyone was very excited about it, apart from the people that weren't. And then last week, the Music Modernization Act was announced in Congress.
Which includes the Music Modernization Act.
It's sort of like the special edition. It's the Music Modernization Act, and there's some extra tracks. And what the extra tracks are other legislative proposals that have been put forward to Washington over the last year, which are also related to music copyright. So rather than there being four, I think, music industry-backed pieces of legislation going through Congress, and there was another one about music rights that wasn't music industry-backed, but there were four that the music industry was backing, rather than that, we're having, well, two. This one, and then the one that will probably never go through is sitting separately, and we can talk more about that in a moment. But at the core of it all is the original aim, which is to fix the way that the song rights are licensed in the streaming domain in America.
Because they're not licensed very well currently.
Now, we have talked about this a lot on Setlist, but to quickly summarise, if you are a streaming service, you need licences from the music industry, you need licences from the record industry to cover recordings, you need licences from the music publishing sector to cover the song rights. In America, the problem is you get your licenses to cover the recordings. You get that of the record companies. You get a Sony, Universal, Warner, Merlin, all the distributors, and you get all of those done, sorted. Then you need to sort out the song rights. So you go to the collecting societies in America. Now, America has four collecting societies for some reason.
Everything's bigger in America.
Everything's bigger and more complicated in America. So whereas in the UK, you would go to PRS and you'd get a license. In America, you go to BMI. And then ASCAP, and then CSAC, and then Global Music Rights, and they all give you a license. And for a brief moment, you might think, well, we're pretty much sorted there. We've done the deals with the labels and distributors over here. We've done our deals with the collecting societies on the publishing side over here. We're ready to go. But there is one snag, which is that a stream exploits two elements of the copyright, the performing right element and the mechanical right element. If you don't know what that means, I've got a book for you. Buy yourself a copy of Dissecting the Digital Dollar. Andy will put a link in the set list notes, because actually he always puts that in.
I always put that link in, even when we don't plug it.
And it sort of says things we've also talked about.
Oh, no, I changed that on the
last
one.
Oh, did you? For a while it was saying things we've also talked about when we didn't talk about it. But if you don't know what that means, buy the book. But basically, you need to have licenses to cover both the performing rights and the mechanical rights in songs. It turns out that BMI, ASCAP, CSAC, and Global Music Rights, they only give you a license for the performing rights. So you say, okay, how do I get the mechanical rights? And in the UK, PRS only do the performing rights. So you'd need an MCPS license to cover the mechanical rights. In the UK, it's simpler than that because PRS work for MCPS. So it's all quite straightforward. In the US, there is no collecting society that can give you a one-stop blanket license for mechanical rights. So basically, you have to identify every single publisher and or songwriter who has a song on your platform that is being streamed, find out what songs they wrote, what recordings those songs are contained within, where they live, and then pay them the royalties. Copyright law says what the royalty is, so you don't need to actually do a deal. It's a set rate, but you need to work out how to pay that set rate too. If you can't work it out, and for whatever reason, blame whoever you like. Who should we blame?
Joe Pasquale.
You're going to blame Joe Pasquale?
Yeah.
He's going to take the entire can for this.
Yeah, because while we were trying to work out who to blame, you told me to pick someone hilarious. And I mean, they don't come funnier than Joe Pasquale, do they?
It's true. Okay.
Titan of the comedy industry.
So because of Joe Pasquale and his devious dealings, quite a few songwriters and publishers in America haven't been paid their statutory rates for their streams. And so some of those people have sued Spotify and most of the other streaming services for stupid amounts of money. And the streaming services are sort of turning around and saying, well, we want to pay you. We just don't know who to pay because you don't have a collecting society and you don't have a blanket license and you don't have a database. What are we meant to do? And so some songwriters say, pay us $150,000 statutory damages per song streamed. Other publishers and songwriters have said, you know what, you're probably right. We need to sort this out. But in order to sort it out, you need to rewrite copyright law. And that is what the Music Modernization Act is about setting up a collecting society, setting up a blanket license. It doesn't actually mean these writers are going to get paid. because all it means is that this new society won't know who to pay, but it won't be liable. But the writers could then go to that society with their data and say, where's my money? So the hope is that this will sort out the problem with licensing song rights and paying song royalties for streaming in America once and for all. But that was the original Music Modernization Act. This one has extras.
Yes, so there's all of that. And also, it now incorporates the Classics Act. And I am not even going to attempt to remember what Classics stands
for.
That
was a really laboured acronym, wasn't it?
Yes. But it seeks to ensure that recordings released before 1972 are paid royalties by online and satellite radio services, because the way that copyright law currently works is weird. And there's a cut-off point between songs released before and after 1972 that just makes things very complicated. So they were trying to sort that out. That's now added into the MMA.
Yeah, I think we've reached our quota of explaining stupid American copyright law technicalities, so we won't go too much into the 1972 thing. But it seeks to fix it, is the point.
Yes, seeks to fix that. Also incorporates provisions to benefit record producers and sound engineers, which were originally included in the AMP Act. Can't remember what that stands for. Summing. And there are a few lines about compulsory license royalty rates that have been pulled in from the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act.
Yeah, so the other thing that the Music Modernization Act V1 did, as well as providing this collecting society and blanket license for the streaming services, is it reforms the way that Copyright Royalty Board and the rate courts in America, when they intervene on rates, either because of a thing called a compulsory license or because it's a collecting society license that goes before a rates court, they're going to change the way those institutions make their decisions on what rates should be paid, and there's going to be more obligation to look at the market and make them more similar to the rates that would be achieved in open market negotiations. The Music Modernization Act V1 was only going to relate that to song rights, so where the song copyright is subject to a compulsory license or collective license. But there is also a compulsory license for recording rights when it comes to things like online and personalised radio. So they're going to take the tweaks from the Music Modernization Act and they're going to apply that to recording, which is basically fulfilling some of the ambitions of this thing that was called the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act.
Yes. Although, interestingly, the core bit of that act is not being pulled into the Music Modernization Act, which would be forcing AM and FM radio stations in the US to pay royalties to artists and labels like radio stations everywhere else do.
Yeah, you're getting very close to another confusing technicality of American copyright.
But we don't really need to talk about that because it's not part of the Music Modernization Act.
But the music industry in America, and we should really say the record industry in America, has been desperately trying to get copyright law in the US changed for years so that AM and FM radio stations would have to pay labels and artists royalties like radio stations do pretty much everywhere else in the world. American stations do pay publishers and songwriters, but they don't pay artists and labels because of the way American copyright law is structured. And so the record industry has been trying to get that changed for ages with this Fair Play, Fair Pay Act. That's V2, because they put the original Fair Play, Fair Pay Act in, and then there was an election and a new Congress, and then they resubmitted it. But although Music Modernization Act V2 has taken some elements of that act when it comes to how the compulsory license rates are set, forcing a royalty onto AM, FM radio is not part of this, even though all the people backing the Music Modernization Act have made a big deal about how this is a complete overhaul of American copyright law, it's going to fix licensing. That's quite a major gap as far as the record industry is concerned.
Yeah.
My assumption is that's going to be really hard to get through. The royalty for AM/FM. They've been trying for a very long time and they've never done it.
Yes, because the radio industry in the US is a particularly powerful lobby and more powerful than the music business.
Not least because talk radio is a really big deal in America. Talk radio is very political in America. So talk radio is sort of like the tabloids of American media. So the radio industry is very powerful in Washington. And so I think the fear probably was, if we put the AM/FM radio royalty for labels and artists into this act, the radio industry is just going to kick the entire proposal out of Congress. And we really need, certainly the streaming bit, we need to get that sorted ASAP, because it's just insane the way it currently works. We need to get that sorted. The whole 1972 thing has been dragging and dragging to get some clarity on that.
I really hope that gets sorted, because I have been bored of that for a really long time now.
So that I never have
since
to
about 1972.
Either write about it or we never have to put that terrible picture of,
of a barrel.
Well, it's two terrible pictures. We've got, yeah, that great, hey, what's wrong with that? I scoured the stock photo libraries.
Did you?
For many, many hours to get that excellent photo of a barrel with 1972 printed on it. No, I wasn't talking about that, which we do often use to illustrate this story. But we also have the photo of Flo and Eddie.
Oh, yeah.
Two members of the Turtles who have led on the litigation on the whole 1972 thing. And we quite often put that cheesy photo of them.
It is pretty cheesy.
If it's particularly related to their lawsuits. So, yeah, the music industry desperate to get streaming licensing and the 1972 thing and all of that, the way that compulsory license, collective licensing rates are set, trying to get all that sorted, don't want the radio industry to kick it out and stop all that happening. So keep the AM/FM radio royalty separate and see if they can get this through. And I suppose that is now the question. Can they get this through Congress and can they get it through quickly? It has bipartisan support in Congress. It's thought that the Donald isn't going to interfere in this. There's hope that the executive will rubber stamp it. There is Republican support for it in Congress. So can they get it through both houses? The perception seems to be, I don't know on what basis this is, but I saw this in a couple of places, that they think it'll go through House of Representatives pretty easily, but there might be some issues in Senate. So we will see. There are detractors. I mean, I suppose most importantly, most of the music industry supports this, and so does the digital music sector, because all those streaming services are desperate to sort out this mechanical rights madness. So it does have support in the digital world and in the music industry. But there are some detractors, including in the music industry. There are some songwriters who feel that this proposed collecting society, well, they're concerned about the governance and, as with any collecting society, what happens to the money they don't know how to distribute, the infamous black box that every collecting society has. So there are some issues, there are some detractors, but there is a lot of cross-industry, cross-party support. So we'll see if they can get it through. I mean, they're hoping to get it through this year. So we'll see if they can speed it through and get all of those things sorted.
Still to come, new double-figure growth for the UK record business, plus some news in brief. But now, while we were out of action, Spotify went and floated on the stock market, completely failing to take into account that we decided to take a brief hiatus from publishing the podcast and selfishly forging ahead with their plans anyway.
They had already announced that date at the start of April.
I know, but we've been waiting for that story to happen for a very long time. And I know that we didn't mean to take a week off, but still, I think they should have just stopped it for like, you know, a week or so that we can have it fresh when we return to publishing, as we are now.
We have talked about it an awful lot on the podcast, on Setlist.
And just in life in general.
And on the CMU podcast that preceded it. And given this podcast goes out on Spotify, there's no excuse for them not to be aware of that.
Exactly.
Because I assume that, you know, somebody at Spotify checks every podcast as it comes in and shares all the key information.
I'm sure it's piped in to the office.
Oh, I guess Daniel Ek probably does that himself.
Yes.
Because it's the most important part of the Spotify business.
That's why they set it up, I think.
Is the podcasts. So yeah, they could have pushed it back a week, couldn't they? But they did list Spotify is now Spot on the New York Stock Exchange. Of course, they got to the New York Stock Exchange via one of these direct listings. Another thing we've talked about a lot on Setlist, because that plan emerged about a year ago, I think. And as a result of that, in the run-up to the actual listing, Daniel Ek, the founder of Spotify, and his team were really playing it down, weren't they? And we talked about that when the SEC filing came out and when they did the live stream investor briefing. But the night before the listing, they put out basically a blog post on the Spotify website, and it was just Daniel Ek saying, tomorrow's just another day. Who cares that we're listing? It's not a day for parties. Everyone was obsessed about them not ringing the bell.
Yeah.
Because when companies float on the New York Stock Exchange, they're meant to go to New York and ring a bell.
I think if I was CEO of a quite, you know, I don't know if you can call Spotify a startup anymore because obviously it's massive. But if I was the boss of a fairly cool tech company, I wouldn't want to go and ring the bell, because if you go, like, Google New York Stock Exchange bell and look at the pictures of the companies ringing bells, they don't look good in any of those pictures. It's not a cool thing to do. I think, I mean, that's probably the main reason Spotify went for the direct listing. So they could just go, look, we're not going to ring the bell because you look stupid when you do it.
If we have to do a proper initial public offering and raise another $2 billion when we launch, but if we have to ring a bell, we're not interested. Keep your $2 billion.
The bell is a deal breaker.
We're gonna quietly arrive on the stock exchange. So no new shares were issued because it was not an initial public offering. So basically what happened, everybody who had shares in Spotify, either because they were early investors or they bought them privately in recent years, or they were a record company that scored a load of equity as part of a licensing deal way back in the early days of Spotify, or they were a staff member. I think quite a lot of the shares being sold as it listed were people who got Spotify shares by working there, all having a very quick cash in. Yeah. So all of those people could now sell their shares on the New York Stock Exchange. And so that is what happened at the start of the month. And although Daniel Ek was really trying to play it down, it was a pretty damn big news story, which I think is why you thought that we shouldn't even be talking about it on this week's set list, because it feels like such old news now that got so much coverage at the start of the month. Although there was a big development nobody else covered. They missed the biggest development of all.
They didn't cover CMU becoming a Spotify shareholder, which I thought was pretty big. I thought everyone would report on that because, yeah, CMU owns one share in Spotify.
We've bought a share.
Yeah. It's called Streamy. It sleeps in a box under Chris's desk. It's very well behaved.
And it just keeps itself to itself. And it's quite exciting to be speaking here now as a Spotify shareholder. So we have a vested interest. I'm not sure if that kind of biases all of our conversations moving forward.
Well, you know, we stand to make a lot of money from our one share.
Unfortunately, so far we've lost money.
I checked just before we started recording. We're currently only 25 cents down.
So when it opened on the stock exchange on the first day, it rose quite a lot, actually, the share price, like $20-$30. And then I think quite a lot of people decided to sell their shares, as we'll talk about in a moment. Sony Music put a bunch of their shares on the market for sale. I think all those staff members were selling. Basically, they all did that to screw us over, because within about an hour of us buying our share for about, what did we pay for it?
We paid $155.17.
So just after we'd paid...
Which is not the highest that they were selling for, but it is not the $132 that they were expected to sell for on the first day.
But shortly after we'd spent that money, it went down. And then it was pretty much about $20 down on that, I think, for much of the rest of the following fortnight. But it is now pretty much back to where we paid for it. So you never know, by next week's set list, we could be profiting from the success that is Spotify. Of course, what this does now mean is when artists or songwriters or labels or publishers are having what we consider to be a unjustified rant at Spotify, and we come on set list and we say, stop saying that, you're wrong. They're just going to say, well, you have a vested interest in Spotify's success, because you wouldn't want to lose your $155. So we'll see whether or not we can... do you reckon we could double our money?
No.
What do you think?
Not at all. I think we might halve it at some point.
What's your prediction?
Wait for the first financial statement to come out, and I think it's probably going to drop quite considerably.
So you think we should, the minute it goes back to 155, we should sell? Is that what you're saying?
No, I want to... I mean, it doesn't matter. We can watch the price go up and down whether we own it or not, but I quite like having one and being able to have that as a benchmark.
So we will keep an eye on the value of our single share in Spotify and see. You never know. We might go up to, say, $175. We could take that $20. What could we get for $20? I think probably...
2 months Spotify subscription.
That's true. In America. Not the UK, because it isn't quite £20. Also, I suspect that probably there'll be about $20 of admin fees on both the purchase and the sale. So come on, Spotify, get up to $200. And then I reckon that'll be enough for me and Andy to go out for lunch. Maybe not dinner.
Yeah, probably a sandwich. Yeah.
But we could do a Pret lunch.
Wow. This was totally worth it.
Providing you don't go for one of the particularly flashy salads, I think we can go for a Pret lunch on the profit of our Spotify share. I mentioned that Sony sort of screwed us over by putting a whole load of their shares on sale just as soon as we bought our share. And I think that has had quite an impact on the price going down, because, of course, it's all about supply and demand. Mm. The more shares there are available, the cheaper they're likely to be. So we know that Sony, Universal, Warner and Merlin, that reps the indies, they all got equity in Spotify as part of their licensing deals. In the run-up to the listing, they've all made commitments to share the profits of that equity when they sell it, certainly with their artists, and in Sony's case, with the indie labels that they distribute predominantly through their Orchard business.
Yeah, which means any money could be spread very thinly. And and as we've discussed before, we don't really know. They've said they're going to share that money. We don't know how. It might be like, oh, well, obviously, as the actual shareholder, we get to keep 98% of the money, but we'll share 2% out with 15,000 people.
Yeah, a lot of people in the music industry are having to get their head around how you decide when to sell, what that process is. Presumably, most of those labels won't want to sell everything at once because they want to flood the market with their entire stock. So we'll see those shares being sold. But Sony did sell, albeit a slice, not a particularly big slice, but a slice of their stock.
Yes, well, Sony said they expected in total to get $1 billion from their shares if and when they sold all of them. On the first day, they got rid of 17% of their shares, which actually was a sizable amount because Sony was the fifth biggest shareholder in the company with 5.7%. So they straight off flooded the market.
Yeah, that's a slightly bigger slice than I implied, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. 17% of $1 billion. That's, you know.
No wonder our share lost its $20
exactly.
in value. Bloody Sony Music. So yeah, it remains to be seen when the other labels start selling that stock and then how they make good on this commitment to share it out with their artists. And it'll be interesting to see if the average artist, not Ed Sheeran, not Drake, but the average sort of middle-level artist, well, we can all go to Pret together and and see if we can afford a better Pret lunch with the profit of our single share versus the extra cash they receive on their royalty statement from their share of their label's sale of the Spotify equity.
I do feel like we might get the better deal.
Well, I'm looking forward to my broccoli and chicken soup on the back of our Spotify investment, although as it currently stands, we're in negative, so that ain't going to happen anytime soon. Of course, now Spotify is a directly listed company, there will be a lot more scrutiny of its financials and its subscriber numbers and its figures. And whereas the other big streaming services, so I suppose that's Apple Music and YouTube, they are ultimately owned by publicly listed companies, but they're such big companies that those figures are hidden deep in the overall reporting of Apple and Google, so it's really hard to know what's going on. And then most of the other big streaming services are still privately owned. The big exception, of course, is Pandora. And what we know about Pandora is every quarter there have been lots of articles about how they're losing subscribers and they're losing money. And they've lost quite a lot of executives in recent years.
Quite careless.
So we will start to see quite a lot of scrutiny every quarter when those reports come out from Spotify, looking at their figures, both in terms of number of subscribers, their growth rates, and the money. Even though we are Spotify shareholders, it is an unproven business model. We don't know if it's going to work. The hope is it will work at scale, but we will see if A, they can get to that scale, and B, if it really does work once they reach that scale. So what this means is, although we will not be able to write about America's stupid 1972 technicality for much longer, hopefully, and although they're going to sort out the mechanical royalties so we won't have all those stupid lawsuits to write about, we will have a quarterly, here's some stats that nobody really understands, let's all speculate wildly about what they mean. So that's something to look forward to in the music business media domain in the years ahead.
Hooray! Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. 80% of deaf and disabled music fans are still experiencing issues buying tickets, according to the latest State of Access report from music charity Attitude Is Everything.
Yeah, so we've talked before about the various reports that Attitude Is Everything put out discussing the accessibility of venues and shows and festivals to deaf and disabled music fans. This one specifically looking at the way tickets are sold to that audience. And I suppose the message being, even if you're an event that has put a lot of effort into making sure that it is accessible to everybody who wants to come and see your show and see your artist play, if they can't get tickets, then all of that is wasted. So as well as doing stuff actually on site, you've got to be thinking about how you sell the tickets and how you communicate the way the tickets are being sold to the deaf and disabled people amongst your fan base.
Yes, this is the fourth year that they've published that report. And although they say things are improving, the stats show that it's a very slight improvement over the last 4 years. So there's still a lot to be done. Music industry trade body UK Music has accused Arts Council England of being too posh for pop after examining the latest round of funding from the arts organisation for the next 4 years. Obviously, Arts Council England provides funds for lots of different creative projects, but UK Music looked at all the money allocated for music and worked out how much had been allocated to different genres. It found that 62% of all the money for music was going to opera and 12.5% was going to pop.
And of course, you always have the issue when we look at Arts Council figures as to what do we even mean by pop? Because it almost means miscellaneous, doesn't it? If you look at the figures, there's opera, there's classical, and then there'll be things like folk and jazz. And then pop is used to refer to everything else.
Yeah.
And it's a misleading term. A few years ago, when the Arts Council did announce that they were going to start putting some money into what became the Mental Music Fund, administered by the PRS Foundation, and they said this is to fund pop music. And of course, people either genuinely or in some cases deliberately misunderstand and assume that that means that the taxpayer is going to start funding One Direction, and everyone gets very angry about that. So there's a problem for starters, is how do we even define this? But yes, so UK Music crunched the figures and said, we're not saying that there shouldn't be funding for opera. We're not saying that that's not a legitimate art form that should be supported by the state, but it does seem a bit wrong that a couple of genres are getting so much of the money and then everybody else is sharing out a really small little chunk at the end.
And the Arts Council has never put a lot of money into, inverted commas, pop, because it's generally seen that it's a self-funding industry, in that the record labels have always put a lot of money into developing new talent, who then grow to be big talents, who then make money that funds the new talent, and that's been the cycle. But when they did launch the Momentum Music Fund in 2013, the Arts Council England's then CEO, Alan Davey, went on Radio 4 to defend himself, because the Today programme said, why are you giving Ed Sheeran and Adele loads of money? And he had to say, that's not what we're doing. And he said there'd been a market failure, and so these emerging artists weren't getting funded anymore. Then the record industry got really shirty about that and said, we're putting loads of money into developing new talent. How dare you? So they are in a little bit of a, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of situation.
I suppose what he was trying to say there back in 2013 is it is definitely true. Record companies, big and small, continue to invest in new talent. And when the record label model works, it's a great model. Commercial entities investing in new talent, and sometimes it really works, and that's great. But I suppose what has happened over the last 15 years, especially in the 2000s, when the record industry's core revenue stream, selling records, was in free fall, what we started to see were labels were signing artists a bit later. And I think that's what the Momentum Music Fund was designed to fill, that gap, whereas perhaps in the past, labels would sign an artist about 18 months into their career. Now they were signing them 3 years into their career, and they needed some help to get from 18 months to 3 years before a label would make that cash investment. And so that's what the Momentum Music Fund was about. But I think to an extent you are right that there's lots of different stakeholders out there who want to criticise them. But when you do see those bare figures and just how much of that taxpayer money is going into one particular art form, which is in some ways a bit of a niche art form, it's also a niche art form that rich people like.
Yeah.
Who could be paying for it. It does feel, and I think that was UK Music's point, that we're not saying that opera should be dumped, but we don't think it should be getting quite that much of the Arts Council spend on music.
That said, if opera needs that much money because it's not commercially viable, I mean, why not just let it die?
And if you did do that, think of all the cash that would then be available to support shitty singer-songwriters with no hope of having a career so they could go and do a tour of the Lake District. So that's our strategy. We're going to stop funding opera, have it dead within 5 years, and then have a lot more terrible singer-songwriters touring the lakes. I think that's a strategy. I think we should stand in some sort of election to run this country's culture policy.
Bit of nostalgia news now. There are new versions of High Fidelity and Empire Records in the works. High Fidelity as a Disney TV series and Empire Records as a Broadway musical, which I'm sure are both things that sound delightful and make everyone listening very happy.
I like the book High Fidelity. I didn't like the film.
I don't think I've read the book, but I watched the film again fairly recently and it is not good.
No.
He comes across really badly. I think you're supposed to kind of be with him, but you're just like, shut up.
Well,
stop whining.
You are with him in the book. I think that's my problem. Also, they really get into America and the book is very British. I've never seen Empire Records.
Have you not? You've got to see Empire Records. It's a great film.
Various people over the years have told me that I should. In fact, I think...
See, I watched that recently as well, and that still is a great film.
I think somebody bought me the DVD. And as
that's a thing that happens, isn't it?
People buy me DVDs and I never watch them. So... yeah, well, I look forward to not seeing either of those.
Well, if you want to know more about any of those stories, go to setlistpodcast.com and find the show notes for this show. And there will be links in there to all of them and indeed everything we're discussing this week. And finally, the UK record business is booming. It's got some double-digit growth going on yet again. But we should also note, bloody YouTube and all that lot, still ruining the whole thing and everything's a disaster.
Sometimes I do feel that when the BPI put out their annual stats, and all the other trade bodies around the world, it's by no means just the BPI here in the UK, when the RIAA in America and all the other similar organisations around the world, almost they do seem to have a template at the moment, which is, it's all great, here's some stats, oh, but it could be greater, and here's some YouTube dissing. Although, of course, now that YouTube have got their premium paid-for subscription service in the pipeline that's going to be great and everyone's going to sign up for, someone told me it's just going to be called YouTube Red Music. It had a working title. What was the working title?
It was YouTube Rewind.
Somebody told me it's just going to be called YouTube Red Music, but whatever.
Neither of those names is good.
I suspect that no one will sign up for this. But BPI did give the fact that YouTube are trying to do that a little name check in their press release, but they did also talk about...
They updated the template.
The old... yeah, they did. So when that bombs in November, let's hope they remember to delete it in next year's use of that template. But while we are critiquing press releases here, as I was walking to the studio to record the podcast, walked in Liverpool Street Station, you know, they have the big screens of news headlines.
I do know that.
The headline was a picture of Ed Sheeran with these stats. So it may be a template press release, but it's getting station screen news update coverage. So
that's
something's
the
working.
Dream.
And maybe, I can't actually remember what the words were on the screen, but maybe it was because of the extra little bit of information that came with the latest stats, which is, you mentioned that double-digit growth, 10.6% for the UK record industry last year. And that is the fastest rate of growth for the British record industry since Britpop.
Yes, since 1995. It was all downhill, and now it's back up again. We're back up to the days of Britpop glory. Do you remember those days?
Yeah, I do, actually.
Yeah, I do too. They weren't that good. But the growth was good.
The growth in the
record
industry.
It was this
industry.
Good. I mean, I assume there was more money at that point.
Oh, a lot more money.
It's currently £839.4 million that the record industry is bringing in, or did bring in 2017.
So that's how much goes into the record companies versus the figures we get at the start of the year, which is how much money went through the till. So it's sort of the trade revenue. But yeah, you're definitely right that the amount of money that was coming in the mid-90s was way more than that. So it's not that revenue figures are outperforming in any way, shape or form the 1990s. It's that the growth rates are. So it's sort of a technicality. And I suppose in some ways that comes back to the fact that these are happy, sad press releases that we keep getting. Because what they are saying is it's great that everything's booming. And it's paid for subscription streaming that's doing that.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. Actually, the streaming revenues grew by 41%. Subscription service income jumped by 45%. And how much streaming revenue came in 1995?
None.
I'm sure we all remember the streaming services of 1995 and how rubbish they were and how little money they brought in.
They were
absolutely
rotten.
Terrible.
But overall, all those plastic discs, all those Blur CDs and Oasis CDs and Pulp CDs, which were the three Britpop acts that actually got name checked in the press release, they were pretty much Britpop, weren't they? Was there anyone else?
Powder. Oh, they played Echo Belly on Six Music last night and I got an Echo Belly song stuck in my head, and that really pissed me off because I hate Echo Belly.
Isn't it customary to mention Menswear when we're trying to mock Britpop? When did Embrace come
Salad.
Along? It all got very boring when Embrace came along, didn't it? Anyway,
it did.
I can't even remember Star how we Sailor. Got into this Britpop. Ugh. Oh, surely Star Sailor's later than Britpop.
I mean,
isn't
it? I know it is, but it's all just like it's just the dwindling dregs of that. Sorry, I've drifted into something now.
And I can't even remember how we got into this Britpop.
Where
this
is going.
I think to conclude, things are going well, but they're not going as well as they could be. And although things may be growing like they did in the 1990s, we were making a lot more money in the 1990s. We liked it when we were making a lot more money. Can we have that back, please? We need to shut the value gap. We need to stop safe harbours. We need to do something else that it said in the press release that I can't quite remember what it was. Oh, there was a Brexit name check, wasn't there?
There was.
Don't sort out the value gap and then screw it all up with Brexit, I think was the general message. But I think that we should note, speaking of Spotify shareholders, that what is driving all of this growth is a very small group of very super duper streaming services that you should all sign up to and start paying every month into those services so that some of us can maybe go up to a Wetherspoons burger.
Wow.
Rather than a Pret
big talk.
Sandwich. So we'll see how it goes.
That's all we've got time for this week on Setlist. You should definitely subscribe to it if you haven't already. It's so much fun.
I subscribed on Deezer, ironically.
Did
despite
you?
Being a Spotify shareholder. So there you go.
Wow, that's the colourful life you lead. Yeah, so do that. And wherever you found it, you should put in a little review and rating, because that really helps somehow, they always say on the end of podcasts. So I assume it actually does. You could tweet us, Facebook us, all those things.
Instagram us.
LinkedIn us, Instagram us. Or you could just email us like in the olden days, like they did in 1995, some people.
I had an email address in 1995.
Yeah, I think I probably did. No, maybe I didn't. I don't know. Anyway, no, I didn't. It's setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Tell us, I don't know, something. Draw us a picture and send that in.
Or make us an offer for that Spotify share.
Or make us an offer for the Spotify share, yeah.
We're aiming for over $200, even okay. though you can currently get it for $150 on the New York Stock Exchange.
Yes, but ours, our share is one of the better ones. The ones they're selling on the stock exchange now are slightly... I think someone dropped them and they got a bit grubby.
Yeah, we dusted
ours
it.
Ours is very clean.
We dusted it.
So you should have it. And we'll give it to you in the box. We keep it in under your desk. But anyway, Setlist, which is this, is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.
I'm going to go to Frankfurt.